Hello. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This is Karen Edwards for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Modern Maturity. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from various sources. Our next adventure, by Ursula Le Guin, from her book No Time to Waste, is called Chosen by a Cat. And this is the last cat blog that we will do. This one's from April 2012. In the 4 months since I wrote about this arrival, little Pard has grown up. He is now not large, but quite solid Pard. He's what they call a copycat, not a leggy one. When he sits upright, the view from the rear is pleasingly and symmetrically globular, a shining black sphere, plus head and tail. But he isn't fat, though not for want of trying. He still loves kibbles. Oh, kibbles. Oh, lovely kibbles. Crunch, crunch, crunch to the last crumb. Then look up with instant infinite pathos. I starve. I perish. I have not eaten for weeks. He would love to be Pardo El Lardo. We are heartless. 1/2 cup of food a day, the vet said, and we have obeyed her. 1/4 cup of kibbles at 7, another at 5. And, well, yes, there is a 1/6 of a can of cat food with warm water on it for lunch, to make sure he gets plenty of water. But he often leaves that till 5 when the kibbles arrive, the one true food. And then he cleans both bowls and goes into the living room and maybe flies around a little, but mostly just sits and digests in bliss. He is a vivid little creature. Youth is so dramatic. His tuxedo is utterly black and utterly white. He is utterly sweet and utterly nutty. Wild as a bronco, inert as a sloth. One moment he's airborne, the next fast asleep. He is unpredictable, yet keeps strict routines. Every morning he rushes over to greet Charles coming downstairs, falls over on the hall rug, and waves his paw in a posture of adoration. He still won't sit on a lap, though. I don't know if he ever will. He just doesn't accept the lap hypothesis. Getting waked up by 20 minutes of strong, steady purring is very nice, plus the nose that investigates the neck, the paw that pats the hair, the increasing intensity of the purr, the commencement of pouncing. By then, it's quite easy to get up. Then he rushes into the bathroom ahead of me and flies around, mostly about waist level, getting into things. And he plays with the water I run for him in the bathtub and then leaps out to make wet flower paw prints here and there. Or if I dribble him water in the basin, he closes the stopper, thus creating a water hole where savage panthers may crouch and wait for dik-diks and gazelles or possibly beetles. Then we go downstairs, one flying, the other not. Closing the drain is typical. He's clever at opening cabinets, too, because he likes getting into things, anything that can be gotten into. Cabinets, drawers, boxes, bags, sacks, a quilt in progress, a sleeve. He is ingenious, adventurous, and determined. We call him the good cat with bad paws. The paws get him into trouble and cause loud shouting and scoldings and seizures and removals, which the good cat endures with patient good humor. What are they carrying on about? I didn't knock that over. A paw did it. There used to be a lot of small, delicate things on shelves around the house. There aren't anymore. Charles bought him a little red harness. He is incredibly patient about putting it on. We thought it would be Charles the bloody-handed for weeks, but no, he even purrs somewhat plaintively during the harnessing. Then the bungee leash is attached, and they go out and down the back steps into the garden for Pard's walk. It went quite well twice. Then a man running by outside the fence, slapping his feet down galump, galump, scared Pard, and he wanted to go back inside at once, and is only beginning to get unscared of all the weirdnesses out there. I think when it stops raining and we can sit outdoors with him, it will be okay. He needs open space to fly around in, that's for sure. But then, of course, we fear he may get too bold in his enthusiasm and ignorance and wander into the wild backyards and thickets down the hill, or chase a bird out into the street and so get lost, or meet the enemy. The enemy comes in so many forms to cats. They are small animals, predators, yet very vulnerable, and Pard has neither street smarts nor wild wilderness wisdom. But he's bright. He deserves what freedom we can give him once it stops raining. Meanwhile, he usually spends a good part of the day with me in my study, sleeping on the printer, about a foot from my right elbow. He fixated on me to start with, and still tends to follow me up and down stairs and keep nearby, though he's gaining more independence, which is good. If I wanted to be the center of the universe, I'd have a dog. My guess is that for the first year of his life in a small and crowded household, he was never alone, so he needs time to get used to solitude, as well as to silence, boredom, never getting pursued or squashed by a passionate baby, etc. Not wanting to be the center of the universe doesn't mean I don't love having a cat nearby. It seems we got his name right. He's a partner, a true companion. I really like it when he sleeps at the top of my head on the pillow, like a sort of fur nightcap. The only trouble with his sleeping on the printer, is that it's 6 inches from my time machine, which, when it's saving stuff, makes a weird, tiny, humming, clicking noise, exactly like beetles. Pard knows that there are beetles in that box. Nothing I can say will change his mind. There are beetles in that box, and one day he will get his paw into it and get the beetles out and eat them. Now for an article from the AARP magazine under Money Saver. This is by Jean Chatsky, To the Rescue, How to Exit a Timeshare. A lot of people want to get out of their commitment. Here's how to get started. The problem. More than 30 years ago, Kim Sini's problem, parents, bought a timeshare near Reno, Nevada. But they hadn't used it in years, and now Sini was helping her widowed mother, Joanne Johnson, 85, unload it, and it's $1,200 in annual fees. But as Sini and many others have discovered, disposing of a timeshare and its associated obligations isn't easy. She failed in her attempts to sell it on eBay or donate it to charity. She then looked at using a timeshare exit company, but its $10,000 fee seemed high. Was there any alternative? This is the advice. Your first move, experts agree, is to check with the resort itself. Ask specifically for the person who handles deed backs or surrenders, which is when you return your property to the company, maybe for a fee of a few hundred dollars. Explain your situation in detail. Almost all the major programs have some sort of deed back program, says Brian Rogers, who runs the 27-year-old timeshare users group online. To qualify, you generally can't be behind on your dues, and you can't have a loan balance. Smaller resorts and developers that don't have official deed back programs may relent anyway. In most cases, the squeaky wheel gets the grease, says Rogers. Just don't get talked into buying more points or upgrading before you're allowed to cancel. Hang up and move on to one of the following solutions. 1. Stop paying. Before doing this, assess your situation. If you stop repaying a loan you took out to buy the timeshare, the lender will try to collect and your credit report will likely suffer. The creditor doesn't care that you bought a timeshare. Rogers says you borrowed money and didn't pay it back. But if you simply stop paying annual fees, a company may not report that to credit bureaus. Often stopping fee payments will push a resort to let you surrender, since that costs it less than foreclosing, said Daniel Blinn, a Connecticut attorney who has handled timeshare cases. The amount of money usually is not enough for the resort to bring suit, he said. They typically will remarket the timeshare. You can resell it. You'll get little or no money, except perhaps for a premium timeshare in a higher-end chain like Disney, Marriott, or Hilton. If you find a buyer, you deed that person the property. Although you'll see listings on eBay and Craigslist, two major forums focus on timeshares. TUG and then the number 2, so that's T-U-G and the number 2.com, the website for Timeshare Users Group, and redweek.com. Use a company to help. Be very, very careful here. The Better Business Bureau said in 2019 that complaints about Missouri timeshare exit companies, an offshoot of timeshares in the Branson area, have exploded in recent years. Complaints revolve around hard sell tactics, fear mongering, no, your kids won't have to keep paying fees after you die, and cases that drag on for years. The biggest red flag, said Rogers, is a requirement that you pay up front. We would never, ever suggest the use of an exit company, period, he said. The only reason to even consider an exit company is if you absolutely can't bear to deal with the timeshare company yourself and you're willing to pay a lot for someone else to deal with it. Prices vary, but around $4,500 is common. The outcome? Exiting was surprisingly easy. Senny called the resort company, explained the situation, and was told they would take the timeshare back if she sent in her father's death certificate. The foreclosure process, which the company says it won't report to a credit bureau, should take less than 6 months. I'm over the moon, she says. I wish I had discovered this 2 years ago. Now, also from AARP, the magazine, we're going to talk about the surprising connection with COVID and the brain. The latest findings tell us that the coronavirus poses a risk to our minds as well as our bodies. Here's your 5-step self-protection plan, and this is by Sanjay Gupta, MD. After 20 years of practicing medicine, Michael J. Stephen, MD, thought he had seen everything. Then COVID-19 hit his hospital, and then it hit him. A critical care pulmonologist at Thomas Jefferson University Jane and Leonard Corman Respiratory Institute in Philadelphia, Michael had been caring for patients while protecting himself as best he could. Then he woke up one Saturday morning in May with a sore throat. By dinner time, he was coughing. And an hour later, he spiked a fever of 103 degrees. Where did I slip up? He kept asking himself, agonizing over having brought COVID-19 home to his 2 school-age children and wife, all of whom subsequently became sick. His family recovered relatively quickly, but Michael, 47, who had been triathlon fit prior to the infection, wound up hospitalized with a left lung filled with blood clots and a brain stuck in a deep fog. Indeed, he felt like he was losing his mind. The splitting headaches and overwhelming fatigue convinced him his brain was on fire. I was doing things I wasn't aware of, he now recalls. I talked out loud in my room during isolation, and my wife kept asking me who I was talking to on the phone. I said nobody, not realizing that I was vocalizing the normal running dialogue we all have with ourselves. I remember thinking several times that I needed to tell my wife to keep my father away from the house, that he has cancer and that he could die if he came over. He did have cancer, but he died in 2007. Michael recuperated after 6 rocky roller coaster weeks. Nonetheless, he feels like something has been forever changed in his body. There's always a bit of a whisper at the back of my mind, wondering if there will be long-term effects. Something could happen down the line. He also thinks of his family members, who could now bear new risk for future health problems. His anxieties are valid. 4/5 of patients hospitalized with COVID-19 have neurological symptoms, and although estimates vary, studies have found that at least 1/2 of people who recover from COVID-19 continue to suffer from neurological symptoms for months after. Brain scans of patients compared with scans of those who've never been affected, show structural and functional changes to the brain. We don't know yet what that means for these patients' long-term prognosis, but the medical community is serious about figuring it out. A global consortium of research scientists has been established to study the relationship between COVID-19 and neurological dysfunction. Their work has taken on greater urgency over the past few months as we grapple with the fact that even those in the highest reaches of government and the military aren't safe from this virus. When we recover from colds, flus, or even pneumonia, we don't often think about an aftermath punch to cognition, yet the connections have always been there. In fact, viruses such as the flu, measles, respiratory virus, and Zika have known neurological effects, as do other types of coronaviruses, including SARS and MERS. These stealthy connections are real, and we're just beginning to document the far-reaching insults that SARS, CoV-2, the virus that causes COVID-19, has on the brain. Some of the most frequent symptoms recorded have been relatively mild, such as headaches, muscle pain, and dizziness. But reports of encephalopathy, or altered brain function, in nearly a third of patients with an increased risk of severe illness and death as a result surprised the researchers. They were also surprised to find that neurological manifestations as a whole were more likely to occur in younger people, although it was more frequent in older. The COVID-19 brain, how this virus attacks the brain and nerves, still isn't totally clear, but researchers are increasingly focused on two primary mechanisms, one direct and the other indirect. In the first, the virus cloaks itself and evades detection as it travels with precious nutrients across the blood-brain barrier and into the fluid that bathes the brain and spinal cord. Once inside, the virus can inflict all sorts of damage to different parts of the brain, and we're still trying to understand this. Early reports reveal that the virus can exploit brain cells to make copies of itself and simultaneously suck up precious oxygen, nearly starving neighboring brain cells. In the other pathway, the virus waves its arms wildly and provokes a counterattack from the body's immune system, which leads to a complex array of immunological effects, such effects can result in inflammatory-related damage to tissues and organs, including the brain. Some combination of these two interwoven paths is a possibility as well. COVID is a chameleon, a disease, said Richard Isaacson, MD, a preventive neurologist at Weill Cornell Medicine and New York Presbyterian Hospital, and host of the American Academy of Neurology's COVID-19 video interview series. COVID affects people in so many different ways and can wreak havoc on just about every organ system in the body. As an infectious disease with potential vascular, inflammatory, and immunology manifestations, it can have wide-ranging neurological effects. Regardless of how exactly the virus harms the body, we now know that the impact of COVID-19 on the nervous system can be more significant and lasting than the transient loss of taste and smell that many of the first infected patients described. It can have devastating short- and long-term neurological complications, from delirium, depression, and temporary brain dysfunction, to headaches, brain inflammation, brain bleeds and clots, nerve damage, and life-threatening meningitis in both the young and the old. Reports of psychosis have also been recorded, with the journal Nature detailing the symptoms of one woman in her mid-50s who saw lions and monkeys in her house and accused her husband of being an imposter. A study published by The Lancet Psychiatry revealed that nearly half the patients who were found to have altered mental status were younger than 60. Among my fellow neuroscientists, there are big questions that remain unanswered. Do these conditions and potential brain changes set the stage for serious long-term cognitive decline and dementia later on? And most important, what can we do about it? These are five approaches that may offer help. How to build a resilient brain. Five simple and positive steps toward growing a healthier, happier brain, now and in the future. Step one, maintain social connection in a physically distanced world. My motto, connection for protection, has taken on a whole new meaning. We may not be able to kiss and hug whomever we want, but we can certainly maintain and even create new, enriching interpersonal relationships, and we should make that a priority. The pandemic has caused widespread emotional distress and increased risk for psychiatric illness. Though we don't know yet if conditions like depression from COVID-19 are happening directly from the infection or if there are other things going on psychologically from the illness to complicate this evolving picture. What we do know is that prolonged social isolation leads to memory loss, and that loneliness is a risk factor for cognitive decline, dementia, and even death. It becomes all the more imperative to fight back against loneliness and remain socially engaged. A tip? When asking about someone's well-being, probe more deeply and refuse to accept a generic, "I'm doing fine." Another tip from my own life, ask for guidance from people. It lets them feel a degree of usefulness that can activate the mind. When you can, participate in virtual chats with friends and family. And when you can see people in person, focus on eye contact. It's more important than ever to ease the stress of masked faces. Plus, University of Chicago loneliness researcher Stephanie Cacioppo told me that the eyes in particular reflect more authentic emotion. Step two, eat for resiliency. There are no such things as immune boosters or superfoods, but there's lots of data behind the advantages of a Mediterranean-style diet rooted in fresh fruits and vegetables, whole grains, lean proteins, including seafood, healthy fats, and nuts and seeds. People who follow anti-inflammatory diets, such as the Mediterranean regimen, may additionally gain beneficial effects against infection itself. The tip? Processed and sugary foods tend to raise inflammation levels. Try swapping out one processed pro-inflammatory meal a day for minimally processed fare grounded in whole, fresh foods. Step three, move more. Exercise remains key to mental sharpness and a healthy immune system. Exercise can counteract the negative effects of isolation and confinement stress on immune function. We also know that exercise improves immune response to infection and could even help to develop better immunity with the aid of a vaccine. All of this ultimately helps protect the brain and its vulnerability in the face of infection. The tip? Access to exercise is better than it ever was pre-pandemic, thanks to a surge in online programming. Find a corner in a room, log on to a virtual class, and get moving. No membership required. And remember, being outside is far safer than being inside, where the virus can linger longer. So discover new, less crowded routes and quieter times of the day to enjoy a brisk walk, run, or bike ride. Step four, boost immunity through sound sleep. Our sleeping habits have changed throughout this pandemic because of shifts in our routine. But now is not the time to lose sleep. It's your free secret weapon to fresh and replenish tissues and cells, among them those of the brain and immune system. It also rinses away waste and debris in the brain that can otherwise foment disease, and it strengthens your memories. After a good night's sleep, you wake up with a smarter body and a sharper mind, better able to deal with the day's stresses. The tip? I used to take at least 30 minutes to wind down before bedtime, but these days I've bumped up relaxing pre-sleep activities, no more screens, to at least an hour. Harvard University psychologist and dream researcher Deirdre Barrett said it's helpful to keep a dream journal as we go through this pandemic. You'll notice patterns in your dreams over time that you might not get from thinking about each individual dream, she told me. Try to prevent anxiety-ridden COVID-19 dreams by actively planning out what you want to dream about before you go to sleep. Step 5, ward off anxiety and fears by learning something new to distract from the negative news. Distance learning is not just for kids. For less than the cost of a pizza a month, you can be a student of dance taught by Misty Copeland, of writing taught by David Sedaris, or of tennis taught by Serena Williams. Finding this sort of purpose-driven activity activates the brain in protective ways. The tip? You can up the challenge of learning something new by teaching a class yourself. Some educational platforms allow anyone, no teaching degree or formal credentials required, to share their expertise and interests with the world. Anything from sign language to survival skills to the stock market. Everyone's life has changed over the past year, and no one welcomed this pandemic. But this situation, however challenging, does allow us the opportunity to engage in new habits and new ways of thinking that can make us more resilient to illness and mental decline. Michael Stephen, MD, is not letting fear get in his way. During his recovery from COVID, he finished authoring a beautiful book about the lungs called Breathtaking, and he's back on the battlefield to coordinate care, save more lives, and help bring an end to the pandemic. Like me, he's betting on a sharper future. And a quick tip, get on the horn. Zoom is challenging for people with vision or hearing loss. Phone calls often work best. Organize. Start a council with other families to advocate about any concerns. One voice can get lost. And find an ally. Nurturing a good relationship with a staff member builds trust. Identify someone reliable you can call on. Well, folks, we've run out of time for today's episode of Modern Maturity. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Karen Edwards, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Modern Maturity is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.